Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowane is off this week. As global temperatures continue to rise, climate change easily captures the headlines. But along with global warming and deforestation, there's a quieter and no less impactful change taking place on our planet. It is the massive and ongoing die-off of numerous plant, insect, and animal species, what our guest today calls the sixth extinction, a phenomenon caused entirely by human activity. Elizabeth Colbert has traveled the world to research her book, The Sixth Extinction and on Natural History. She's won a Pulitzer for her efforts. And last night, Colbert was given the Richard Hopper Day Memorial Award at Drexel University's Academy of Natural Sciences. She is here with us in studio. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 888-477-9499. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Elizabeth Colbert, so nice to have you here for Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
So the name of your book is The Sixth Extinction. Scientists have documented five previous mass extinctions in the last half billion years, the last of which perhaps most famously involved the dinosaurs. Let's start here. Do we know with some certainty what the catalysts were for those extinctions?
In some cases, we have a pretty good idea. Most notably, the extinction event that did in the dinosaurs, which goes by various names, the end Cretaceous extinction, the KT extinction, although that has now since been replaced by the KPG extinction. That has to do with scientific notation. And that was, there's a pretty broad consensus that that was caused by an asteroid impact. And we, in fact, scientists have identified the enormous crater, which is actually under the Gulf of Mexico, where that impact actually took place.
And this impact wiped out what percentage of living creatures / plants on this planet?
Well, a very rough figure is about 75% of all species on Earth died out. And what's very notable about the event, you know, besides just those massive numbers, are it did in, you know, 100% of the dinosaurs, or what are now called the non-avian dinosaurs, because one branch of dinosaurs are what we now consider birds. But they had 100% extinction rate, and some other, you know, pretty important and widespread groups that are not quite as well known, as famous to us as the dinosaurs, were also done in at that time.
So fast forward millions of years to 2016, and in your book, you have found in your research that we are in the middle of another extinction, and this one is caused by human beings, human activity?
Yes. I mean, it's certainly not my discovery. It's very widely alluded to in the scientific literature, the phrase the sixth extinction. You will find, if you search the scientific literature frequently, and the idea here is simply that all the ways that humans are changing the planet, we are unfortunately having an impact not all that dissimilar from an asteroid. We are changing the world extremely rapidly, and we're changing the world everywhere all at once. We're having a real global impact. There's nowhere you can go anymore on the planet, and that includes deep into the oceans and certainly to the poles, where you could not find very clear evidence of human impacts.
You begin in your prologue by talking about this new species, which emerges about 200,000 years ago, and after reproducing and fits and starts, begins to take off. And here's where I will ask you, if you mind, to read a passage from your book. It is the passage on page 2.
In a single century, the population doubles, then it doubles again, and then again. Vast forests are razed. Humans do this deliberately in order to feed themselves. Less deliberately, they shift organisms from one continent to another, reassembling the biosphere. Meanwhile, an even stranger and more radical transformation is underway. Having discovered subterranean reserves of energy, humans begin to change the composition of the atmosphere. This, in turn, alters the climate and the chemistry of the oceans. Some plants and animals adjust by moving. They climb mountains and migrate toward the poles. But a great many, at first hundreds, then thousands, and finally perhaps millions, find themselves marooned. extinction rates soar, and the texture of life changes. No creature has ever altered life on the planet in this way before, and yet other comparable events have occurred. Very, very occasionally in the distant past, the planet has undergone change so wrenching that the diversity of life has plummeted. Five of these ancient events were catastrophic enough that they're put in their own category, the so-called Big Five. In what seems like a fantastic coincidence, but is probably no coincidence at all, the history of these events is recovered just as people come to realize that they are causing another one. When it is still too early to say whether it will reach the proportions of the Big Five, it becomes known as the Sixth Extinction.
Elizabeth Colbert, your book tackles species both extinct and species still with us, but in danger of extinction. And you traveled the globe to document some of the changes that are happening. Let's go to central Panama and the village of, is it El Valle, which, as you write, sits in the middle of a volcanic crater formed about a million years ago. Tell us what you found walking down the main street through the market in El Valle.
Well, El Valle is a really tiny town in a very beautiful place, kind of tough to get to. You have to come down the winding road that leads into this sort of ancient volcanic caldera. And it's a town known for these fantastic yellow frogs, the Panamanian golden frog. It was sort of at the center of their range when they had a range. And it's filled with, or it was, at least when I went, with little statuettes of these golden frogs doing all sorts of things that frogs don't do, smoking cigarettes, dancing, holding cell phones. People had, for some reason, decided to that just being a frog wasn't enough. And so they had the frogs doing all sorts of human activities, which was sort of interesting and sort of sad, I guess, in consideration of what's happening to these frogs.
Well, it was a huge part of their culture, it seems. Describe the golden frog for us. What did it look like?
Well, the Panamanian golden frog is a small frog, couple inches long, very bright yellow, like a New York City taxi cab. Many of them have these sort of brownish blotches on them. They have sort of a pointy nose and very thin limbs, bright yellow limbs, and they are really interesting creatures for a couple of reasons. First of all, they're highly toxic. They contain a very significant amount of poison, which prevents them from being eaten. They obviously stand out very clearly against the forest floor. So this toxicity of theirs, you know, their color is sort of warning other creatures, you know, stay away. And the other thing that was really interesting about them, or another thing, is they live near running water. They actually lay their eggs in running water, and they don't call or hear even, but they communicated with each other by this sort of semaphore, by waving to each other. So they're really, really interesting animals. You know, I'm not sure I've stated that explicitly here. They're now extinct in the wild. Yeah. And the ones I saw in El Valle were in a biosecure facility that you could only enter wearing bleached shoes.
And so there are just a few left.
Yes, there are just a few left. There are some in zoos in the U.S. People have successfully bred them in zoos, but there are none left around in their native range out in the rainforest.
So two quick questions before we get to the break. They started to disappear. What was the cause?
Well, they started. What happened was scientists noticed, one scientist in particular, a woman named Karen Lips, who was doing her graduate work in Costa Rica and Panama, started to notice that amphibians were just disappearing from pretty remote places. You would just go one month they'd be there, then she would go away for a couple months, come back, and there were just no amphibians. And people were noticing these amphibian die-offs in very disparate parts of the world. And what happened was they eventually traced it, the causality, to a fungal disease that was spreading through the rainforest in Central America and then in other parts of the world. And people actually could watch it move through Central America. So they, the reason that there are still some Panamanian golden frogs in captivity is that people realized, scientists realized that this fungal disease was moving, in this case, from a west-to-east direction, and they actually took them out of the forest before the fungus swept through. And then it did sweep through, in fact.
And as you write this, you yourself admit this is something of a morbid topic, but you write with a touch of humor, Elizabeth Colbert. When biologists were scrabbling to get ahead of the problem and were trying to get a new lab facility built, they put the frogs up, the ones that they found. What did they put them up in?
Yeah, they wanted to build this biosecure facility, but the disease arrived sooner than they thought. So they booked the frogs into a hotel. That's actually how I read about them in a kid's story in National Geographic Kids. And I went to visit the hotel. It's a little guest house, and the frogs stayed in the guest house for quite a while, for a number of months before they had permanent accommodations. How's that?
Wait. So when it comes to writing about really very serious topics, where do you find the humor, and why do you choose to use humor?
Well, I think that my goal, you know, with a book, I guess anyone's goal with a book is to get people to read on. And I think that humor, enlivens, as you say, a pretty grim topic. And it's also just, everyone has their own voice, I suppose. And mine tends to be a little bit, I don't know about humorous, but wry. We'll use the word wry. How's that?
Okay, that works. Well, one more question before we move on from the golden frog. Where was the connection between this fungus and human activity?
Well, the fungus was pretty clearly being moved around the world. It appeared simultaneously, as I said, in very disparate parts of the world. In Australia, some really interesting frogs died off. In Central America, in Europe. So people were seeing these die-offs in very different parts of the world, and they immediately suspected that this must be something being moved around the world by people, because, you know, a fungus can't, you know, cross the Pacific Ocean very easily without help. So that is still the, working theory, that something was moved around the world, and the genetics of this fungus shows that they're all very closely related. So presumably they must have been moved around. Now, no one knows how they were moved around, and no one also knows, interestingly enough, though a lot of genetic work has gone into it, where it originated.
All right. We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert this hour of Radio Time. She is author of the Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Sixth Extinction and a Natural History. And also tonight, she's giving a free lecture open to the public at Villanova University as part of their One Book Villanova program. If you'd like to chat with Elizabeth Colbert right now, 888-477-9499 is the number. And we invite you to stay with us as Radio Times continues. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and our guest this hour is Elizabeth Colbert, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction and a Natural History. And as always, the number is 888-477-9499, or you can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Elizabeth, you write that throughout much of human history, there was no concept of extinction.
Yeah, extinction didn't come up for quite a long time, and there were. It's quite interesting. Obviously, it predates evolution. Extinction was actually not understood, but accepted as a sort of fact, I suppose, before evolution was, about a generation or two. But until the beginning of the very end of the 18th century, early 19th century, people were perplexed, you know, by a lot of things they found that didn't make sense. But the world was a very big and still relatively unexplored place. So you have a pretty famous example of Thomas Jefferson when he sent Lewis and Clark out west, hoping they would come upon a live mastodon. He was convinced that they were still out there somewhere.
So he didn't accept the concept of extinction?
He was pretty opposed to it, and he has a very famous quote about how, you know, the was this idea of the great chain of being. It was the creation, and why would God create something only to get rid of it? And so he said much more poetically than I will remember, you know, it's impossible that each link in this chain is so strong that it must, you know, it's got to be still around.
So he's hoping that Lewis and Clark find a mastodon, and this is because a molar was discovered in upstate New York.
Well, there were a lot of mastodon findings as Americans moved into the New World. Mastodons, the American mastodon, as it's called, could only be found in North America. And as the Europeans came to North America, they found, you know, mastodon parts lying around, literally. I mean, mastodon remains are pretty common. And one incredible find was out in near what's now Cincinnati, a place called Big Bone Lick, which is now a state park in Kentucky that I actually visited. And it was just filled with bones of extinct creatures, including mastodons. And people just hauled out huge collections of them. And Thomas Jefferson got some of them. Thomas Jefferson's fossil collection, which is here in Philadelphia, as I understand it, probably contains the mastodon parts. But a really big find, a find that really kind of shook up the American scientific establishment, I suppose, and also involved Thomas Jefferson, was a whole and relatively intact mastodon skeleton that was found in upstate New York. And that was a big deal. There's a painting by Charles Wilson Peale, The Exhumation of the Mastodon, and that documents Charles Wilson Peale, who's from Philadelphia and had the country's first natural history museum here, no longer exists. But he was a real pioneer, and he was also a real showman. Mm. And he heard about this skeleton in upstate New York. Actually, Thomas Jefferson wanted to get his hands on it, but failed. And Peale came up and he sort of wheedled it out of the guy who had it. Oh. And then he set up this water wheel to, you know, power the exhumation. It was a big deal. And then Peale painted the scene too.
Yeah. Let's get to Charles Darwin. He believed, you know, of course, you know, there was evolution. He also thought extinction was the other side of the same coin. And yet you write about, you know, when he was at the Galapagos and he observed the rapidly declining numbers of this Charles Island tortoise, he still didn't quite put the pieces together that this animal was on the road toward extinction, but it wasn't a natural process, that man was behind this.
Well, I have to sort of go back a step, which okay. is to say that extinction was first sort of theorized, if that's the right word, by a French naturalist who was incredibly famous in his day, Georges Cuvier. There was no one more famous in the beginning of the 19th century in scientific circles. And Cuvier believed that species went extinct owing to some catastrophic event. This is what, you know, we now know as catastrophism. And he posited there had been, you know, these great extinction events where a lot of things had gone extinct at one time. Owing to some great change on the surface of the earth, what he called a revolution on the surface of the earth. And when Darwin came along, and Cuvier was greatly opposed, adamantly opposed to the idea of evolution, which existed in a kind of fuzzy form in his day and was advanced by another Frenchman, Lamarck. And when Darwin came around, he was very much reacting to these sort of fuzzy ideas that had come before him. And one of the ideas that he threw out was the idea of catastrophism. So he says, there's nothing mysterious about extinction. It's just things evolve, more fitter species evolve and they push out those that are less fit. So there's no need to invoke these catastrophes that have, you know, caused devastation on the surface of the earth.
So was he saying then that the disappearance of these tortoises, which are just being harvested en masse people who were sailors and, you know, people who were on ships and et cetera. So he's saying that this was a natural process, that they're just being pushed out by human beings?
No, he just really ignores that. He certainly acknowledges that humans, you know, can devastate creatures. He sort of alludes in passing to this fact. But he insists in his writings that there's no such thing as catastrophism. So he just sort of passes over the question of is this part of the evolutionary process or is this something different? And that fact really, Darwin's view of things is so strong that what he really sort of delays the understanding of is events like the extinction of the dinosaurs. Darwin and his sort of colleagues, I guess, and his followers insisted that since there was no such thing as catastrophism, where it looked like a lot of things had gone extinct simultaneously, that was probably a problem with the fossil record. So it takes people a long time to get their minds around the idea that there was a big extinction event, for example, that did in the dinosaurs.
All right. We're going to get to your trip to Reykjavik and talk about the great auk, which is extinct. But first, let's get to some telephone calls. Bill in Wynwood, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Bill.
Great. Yes. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. The show is fantastic. My observation would be that considering so much is being learned scientifically of the environmental changes and the direction in which we're headed and its impact on this potential extinction event, the next event, the timing for your discussion and your discussion out of Villanova tonight couldn't be better as it relates to the political environment one, because we find ourselves now with two candidates, one of which, Donald Trump, who insists that regulations need to be unwound. So what we have here is scientific evidence that the world is heading towards trouble. If we know that it's environmental regulation that protects the world longer term, or that's its intent, and we have a candidate who insists on unwinding regulation, which to me would be counterproductive to the health of the environment and the planet. So that's my observation. I'm curious to know the author's comments around some of that. Thank you.
Thank you for the call to Radio Times, Bill. Well, we were going to get to politics at some point this hour, Elizabeth Colbert, so sooner rather than later. You know, he's talking about, I'm assuming, Donald Trump, who, you know, has said on the campaign trail that he would abolish the EPA if he could. So, you know, and he's not the only one who, you know, there are climate change deniers or some who are very vocal about it in higher levels of government. So how do you see this situation playing out?
Well, I think, you know, anyone who in the scientific community, and there was just a big letter signed by many, many scientists objecting to Donald Trump and his really casual and quite disturbing dismissal of the science and kind of, I mean, it would be comic if it didn't have such serious potential consequences. So we support, you know, as a country, we support, you know, the best scientists in the world who are doing extraordinary work. And then as a country, we also seem capable, you know, of electing people who just ignore it. So it's really quite schizophrenic on that level. And, you know, I certainly agree with our caller that it would be really, really dangerous to, you know, move in the direction of dismantling the environmental regulations that we have right now when we are confronted with really, really serious impacts that, you know, really can't be overstated. The impacts of climate change are difficult to exaggerate. We may not see them immediately right now, but the thing that's important to understand about climate change is that there's a big time delay in the system. There's a lot of heat, you know, that's going into the oceans, that's going into melting ice, and we're not going to feel the full effects of our own actions today until our kids, you know, are our age. And so we are really leaving an incredible mess to our children And people, I think, really need to wake up and deal with that, or our kids are going to be in a great, great deal of trouble.
Before we move on with calls and comments, Donald Trump has promised to bring back coal. Coal's a great, you know, polluter. Hillary Clinton wants to transition employees of coal to jobs in cleaner energy. But, you know, the people in these jobs do need to feed their families. It's going to take a while to transition to different forms of energy, to cleaner energy. How do you address that conundrum?
Well, I think that now is the perfect time to address that because in the first place of the urgency of the problem, coal, you know, per unit of energy, so for how the amount of electricity that you get out of it, produces more carbon dioxide than any other fuel. But coal prices have tanked. You know, coal is not economically viable at this point. So I completely agree that we need, as a society, to not just leave a whole industry in the lurch. You know, when the automakers were going under, we stepped in, we bailed them out. There are certainly ways that we could help people in traditionally coal mining communities, and we ought to do that. Now, once again, though, I think people need to understand that we would do that, you know, through government action. So if we're advocating, you know, dismantling the government, you know, clearly that won't get done. But there are certainly ways that we could help coal mining communities that don't involve, you know, digging up more coal, which, as I say, is economically not even viable at this point.
All right. Let's get to an email from Nick, who asks, just wondering, why do so many scientists and others speak about the causes of mass extinctions like they are facts instead of as theories produced from the latest careful studies? What makes them as certain as past experts who expressed in the same manner theories that have since been updated?
Well, I mean, in the case of a lot of extinctions, you know, we're watching them in action. So, for example, you know, we watched this fungal disease come through and we watched species go extinct. So I think that stating that, you know, as close to fact as we've got, you know, as we watch a disease, let's say a pathogen, move through and cause extinctions. Now, you know, prospectively, what's going to happen? So, for example, there is a lot of literature looking at, you know, do we expect climate change to become a big driver of extinction? That is prospective. And, you know, unfortunately, we won't know the answer to some of these questions until it's over. I think that, you know, the reason that people are urging action on the basis of, you know, what you could argue is this prospective thinking is because once it's over, you know, that creature's gone. So it's a little bit too late at that point. So testing these theories, unfortunately, involves, you know, potentially massive consequences.
So as promised, your trip to Reykjavik, you went to observe the remains of one of the last of the great auks, and they vanished in the mid-1800s. Tell us about this one bird, which ended up after its demise in the hands of a Danish count.
Well, this the great auk was a flightless bird. It was one of the few flightless birds we have here in the Northern Hemisphere. It was a big bird, sort of penguin-sized bird, a really beautiful bird. You can see them in stuffed examples in many natural history museums. It was, you know, very common, very widespread on the east coast of the U.S. And also in Europe and in Scandinavia and in Iceland. And by the early part of the 19th century, by the early 1800s, it only existed in a few places. And then it became the victim of its own rarity, which often happens, unfortunately. It became very valuable to collectors. So the last known great auks, probably not the very last ones in the world, but the very last known ones, were on an island called Eldey, which is off Reykjavik. You can see it. If you fly into the international airport in Iceland, you see this island in the distance. And some guys took a boat out there and caught the very last great auks and skinned them and sold them to a collector. Mm.
Let's go back just a little bit. Part of the issue was they were delicious to Europeans who were lured to the area, Funk Island, you know, by the cod fishery. And if you could, I'd like you to just read a passage about what, you know, what happened to what tens of thousands of these birds. And again, we're going to page 59 of your book.
Yeah, well, these are birds that were actually off the coast of Canada. So as people came, as you say, as Europeans came to fish the incredible cod fishery off the coast of Canada. So toward the end of a long transatlantic journey, when provisions were running low, fresh meat was prized, and the ease with which auks could be picked off the slab — this is a slab of an island off Canada — was soon noted. In an account from 1534, the French explorer Jacques Cartier wrote that some of the Isle of Birds inhabitants were as large as geese. They are always in the water, not being able to fly in the air, inasmuch as they have only small wings with which they move as quickly along the water as the other birds fly through the air. And these birds are so fat, it is marvelous. In less than half an hour, we filled two boats full of them, as if they had been stones, so that besides them, which we did not eat fresh, every ship did powder and salt, five or six barrels full of them. A British expedition that landed on the island a few years later found it full of great fowls. The men drove a great number of the fowls into their ships and pronounced the results to be quite tasty, very good, and nourishing meat. A 1622 account by a captain named Richard Whitbourne describes auks being driven onto boats by hundreds at a time, as if God had made the innocency of so poor a creature to become an admirable instrument for the sustenance of man. Over the next several decades, other uses for the great auk were found besides sustenance. As one chronicler observed, the great auks of Funk Island were exploited in every way that human ingenuity could devise. Auks were used as fish bait, as a source of feathers for stuffing mattresses, and as fuel. Stone pens were erected on Funk Island. This is another island off Canada. Vestiges of these are still visible today.
We'll talk some more about that in just a moment. Elizabeth Colbert, she is author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction and a Natural History. And we're getting calls and comments. The telephone number, 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And there's more of Radio Times straight ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are having a conversation with Elizabeth Colbert, author of The Sixth Extinction and a Natural History. And going into the break, we were talking about the demise of the great auk, wiped out in the early to mid-1800s. And we were also discussing in the mid-16th century Europeans who discovered this bird. There are a lot of them off the coast of Canada, Newfoundland. And you get the sense, Elizabeth Colbert, that as they were consuming huge numbers of these birds, there was no sense really of conservation or even of compassion for these creatures.
Yeah, there are really horrible stories of the birds, you know, being basically plucked. At one point they were, you know, being used for feathers, for mattresses, and just left to die because, you know, obviously a bird with no feathers. So when they didn't even want to eat them. So there was, you know, flightless birds are as it were sitting ducks, and they can't get away. And it is a really horrible story. And some people were — I do want to say that some of the accounts that we have were people who were, you know, kind of horror struck by the way these animals were being treated.
Do you see this perspective in some forms still existing in this day and age toward any number of species or nature in particular?
Well, I think that we definitely, you know, do. We're having a, you know, an elephant poaching crisis right now. And, you know, people are driven by a certain kind of desperation. So I don't want to, you know, yeah. I don't want to just say that, you know, I don't want any of us, you know, sitting here in the U.S. to be sort of smug about it. This crisis is taking place in Africa. That's where elephants are, African elephants. And it is really threatening the very survival of African elephants. I hope Americans are aware of that.
I guess I'm talking about, I'm sorry for interrupting,
sure.
about the overuse of resources versus a sense of conservation, and this is all we have.
Well, I mean, I think that that is the case with elephants. You know, they're being killed for their ivory, then left, you know, the rest of the elephant is just left to rot. And there are gruesome pictures on the web, if anyone's interested, of that. So, yeah, that's an overuse, you know, of a quote-unquote resource. There are all sorts of instances that we can use. Rhinos are being killed for their horns. I mean, they're, you know, just stuff that we would consider absolutely crazy and terribly wasteful, and especially for big animals that are slow to reproduce, putting them on a, you know, glide path towards extinction.
So there are suggestions as to what to name this age we humans seem to be ushering in. There are a lot of verbal landmines here for me, Elizabeth Colbert. The
catastrophizoic, I think.
Catastrophizoic, I love it. Yeah. Or homogenocene?
Homogenocene,
okay.
I think.
So
yeah.
what are they, you know, what is the thrust here of the meaning?
Well, a lot of scientists, and there are now very, very serious efforts to rename the geological time that we live in. So we live in what's, you know, officially known as the Holocene, mm-hmm. And that is it's what geologists would call an epoch, and it began about 12,000 years ago when the last ice age ended. So a lot of the northeastern U.S. was covered with ice, a mile of ice, until about 12,000 years ago. Then the ice sheet started to recede, and that's the Holocene. And that's the period in which all of what we think of as the history of civilization took place. And now a lot of scientists would argue, are arguing, that human impacts on the planet are so great that we have ushered in a new geological epoch. And the actual name that's under consideration is the Anthropocene,
you know,
the age of man, that we have ushered in this new geological time that should be named after us because we have become the major geological force on the planet.
Not flattering.
It's not meant to be flattering, no.
All right, back to the phones. Paul is in Hamilton, New Jersey. And Paul, you're live on Radio Times.
Yes. The fact of the matter is I think many extinctions today are because of the importing of other animals and because of introducing invasive species. And these invasive species are going to basically slaughter and eat the indigenous species. And this is the result of globalization. Okay, so I think part of the cure is to, you know, have more checks on shipping, less overseas trade, and greater control on flight and transport.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point, and it's a very, you know, right now, as the caller suggests, introduced species, invasive species, are a major driver of extinction, and that's particularly true on islands, you know, places where species evolved, you know, in the absence of certain predators, let's say, and then you bring in cats or you bring in, you know, rats, and it really devastates the native fauna. And, you know, we're definitely seeing now, if we get back to the frogs, and this fungal pathogen is in the U.S. and has killed a lot of frogs here and driven some species very, very close to extinction. You know, it can be a pathogen. It can be a microscopic organism. So global trade, global travel, those are big extinction drivers and only probably going to get more serious as time goes on. The problem is, and I certainly agree with their caller that we should have stricter monitoring and stricter controls. The problem is that often we don't even know what we're looking for, right? Because these pathogens come up, crop up. We didn't realize that they were pathogens until we start seeing animals drop dead. And they're microscopic. It's very, very difficult, you know, to check everyone on an airplane or whatever for something that you're not even sure what you're looking for. But certainly, you know, there are a lot of people thinking about ways, how can we prevent the spread of pathogens and of, you know, animals that we don't want coming, you know, crossing oceans.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times, Paul. Richard sends an email. He says, I have little hope that any of us who live in wasteful capitalistic economies will do what's necessary to change the direction of climate change. Case in point, the only people I know who don't have cars have chosen this because of financial considerations, not environmental reasons. Is there the slightest reason for hope?
That's certainly a good question. It's an interesting question today, when the news is semi-hopeful, I suppose, which is that enough countries have signed on to what's called the Paris Accord, which was negotiated last year, to try to begin to bring the world's carbon emissions down. How that will play out, whether that is, you know, sufficient to be labeled hopeful or not, remains to be seen. But I guess there are some hopeful signs. I think there are some hopeful signs. Whether they're, you know, enough or not, I guess I'm going to leave it to other people to decide, really, you know, whether you decide that these are sufficient cause for hope.
So from what you've seen of research, if all countries involved in the Paris Accord were to put into effect all the restrictions that they're talking about, is there a sense that this might slow or even reverse what you call the sixth extinction?
Well, that's a difficult question to unpack. The first point I would make, though, is that climate change is not the sole driver of this extinction event, as we were just discussing, invasive species, habitat loss. So there's a lot of drivers of what's going on. So I think we don't know how significant climate change is going to be in terms of driving extinctions yet. Now, reversing climate change is very close to impossible. It's not absolutely impossible, but it's very, for all practical purposes, it's impossible. So what we are talking about now is slowing or mitigating. You know, we want the eventual temperature increase to be as low as possible. And as I mentioned before, there's already a great deal of warming, you know, sort of in the pipeline. So what we really need to do, if we were really, really serious about this, is we would be drawing down our, you know, emissions to zero as quickly as possible. Instead, we're sort of trying to stabilize them, you know, just keep them at the same point and then sort of slowly begin to draw them down. But people use the metaphor of a bathtub. Even if you slow down the amount of water you're filling a bathtub with, you're still going to eventually fill the bathtub. So we really need to stop filling that bathtub. And the question of, you know, when and whether we're going to do that is very much open at this point.
Let's get to the oceans for a few moments. The air in the oceans communicate as far as CO2 is concerned?
Yes. Everything that we put up into the air ends up dissolved gases, ends up dissolving in the surface waters of the ocean. Very, very significant proportion of the CO2 that we will put up into the air will eventually work its way into the oceans, and already about a third of it has. So about a third of the carbon dioxide we have put up into the air since the start of the Industrial Revolution is already dissolved in the oceans. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. So we are acidifying the oceans. We are changing the chemistry of the oceans. That's just a fact. We can measure it. And that has potentially very, very serious repercussions.
What do we know of ramifications regarding species in the oceans?
Well, one thing that one group of organisms that seems to be potentially seriously affected are reef-building corals, who build reefs out of the mineral calcium carbonate. And just because of the chemistry of how you go about doing that, it becomes harder and harder to do that as the chemistry of the ocean changes. So people are very, very concerned. I shouldn't say people. Marine biologists are very, very concerned about the future of the world's coral reefs, which are home to something like a quarter of all marine species on the planet. So that is a really, really serious warning, I think.
So ocean acidification is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin. Why do we not talk about this more in public discourse?
You know, that's a really good question. We should be talking about it more because there are, by some accounts, it could potentially have even more serious ramifications. And that includes for humans, because the oceans are really, really important to us, whether we realize it or not. I think the reason is simply, you know, we're a terrestrial species. So we relate to, you know, air temperatures and we relate to, you know, air quality a lot more than we do to water quality or water temperatures. Now, another thing that's happening to the oceans that is huge, really huge and potentially huge for us again, is they are absorbing a lot of the heat. So a lot of the heat, the extra heat that is being retained close to the surface of the Earth because of the CO2 we're putting up there, most of it is also going into the oceans. And the oceans are warming very, very fast. And that has also potentially huge repercussions.
We're going to try to get one more call in here to Radio Times to Delaware County now. And Michael. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question for your guest is, what does she think the contribution of air travel to climate change and consequently to species extinction is, since it doesn't look like it's going to go into one direction with the growth of airlines and the Chinese middle class? It looks like there will just be many tens of millions more traveling by air, and even your scientific studies were accomplished by traveling by air, and yet each seat contributes so many tons of carbon to the atmosphere.
Thanks for the question to Radio Times, Michael.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, right now, air traffic is still a pretty small proportion of you know, total global emissions, but as you mentioned, it's a growing proportion, and air travel is growing and could potentially become even more significant. Now, each time you fly, definitely, you know, the carbon emissions associated with each seat are very, very significant. So flying, you know, is a big deal. But that being said, right now, you know, there are still many, many bigger, you know, contributors. I mean, you know, simply car travel, truck travel are much bigger contributor to our carbon emissions right now than air travel, even though each individual air travel trip is a very significant carbon. There's very significant emissions associated with it.
Elizabeth Colbert, you write in The Sixth Extinction, in an extinction event of our own making, what happens to us? What happens to us?
Well, that's very much an open question. I mean, there's 7.4 billion of us on the planet right now. So, you know, we're a very widespread species. We're a very numerous species. We're a very adaptable species. So, you know, if you had to make a bet about what kind of species could survive living with humans, you would probably bet on humans. Now, that being said, you know, we are mucking around with very, very basic geochemical and biological systems that we depend on, whether we like to sort of acknowledge it or not. So once you're, you know, mucking around with the oceans, you know, which cover 70% of the planet, you're really, really toying with some pretty, pretty big forces. So, you know, the ultimate trajectory that we're on is very unclear, and I want to say still very much up to us. I don't think the die has, you know, been cast here. We have a lot of decisions to make about what we want the future to look like. And I think if there were one thing, one message I would, you know, like to leave your listeners with, it is that we're making a lot of these choices right now unconsciously, and we should be making them consciously.
Elizabeth Colbert, thank you so much. It was so nice to have you with us in studio.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert won a Pulitzer for her book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And last night she was awarded the Richard Hopper Day Memorial Medal at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. And tonight, in a free lecture open to the public, Colbert will speak at Villanova University as part of their One Book Villanova program. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page. Tell us what you think. Become part of the Radio Times family. Just head to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you will find our podcast there as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us for Radio Times.